You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of IAS 2007, the fourth International AIDS Society conference on HIV pathogenesis, treatment, and prevention. Sydney, Australia, July 22nd through July 25th, 2007.
This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of the Body Pro. I'm here in Sydney, Australia at IAS 2007 with Dr. Tony Mills, assistant professor of clinical medicine, David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. Dr. Mills is also the lead investigator for the Duet 1 study.
What do you think were the studies at IAS with the most impact in terms of changing clinical practice?
I think that we have access right now through expanded access programs to several novel agents, and so those are really available to HIV practitioners across the country. And so I think that what we saw in this meeting was we saw some really great data talking about the efficacy of those novel agents, raltegravir, TMC-125, vicrovirac, which is in trials now but not in expanded access. And so I think that that data is really important as far as sort of changing the way that we actually practice. I think it's going to make people feel a lot more comfortable using some of these novel agents and will certainly translate, I think, into better patient care.
And in terms of the when to start treatment debate, which there were a few sessions about that, have you changed when you start people in therapy, and if so, why?
Yeah, I have changed, and one of the actually things that I was most excited about coming to this meeting about was I wanted to see what other people were thinking and see if other people were feeling the same way that I was. And I think I went to every one of those sessions on when to treat, because again, it's something that's so important to all of us. My sense is that the pendulum's really shifting, and I was certainly a person who adopted pretty early on, get people off of therapy if it's toxic, if they've got good T-cell counts, let's wait till the last minute to start their antiretrovirals. But I think we have increasing evidence to show that starting people earlier on therapy is extremely beneficial, that the earlier we start, the better people do, the easier it is to suppress the virus, the fewer side effects that they have. And I think it's also extremely important as far as HIV prevention goes. You know, my sense in being involved in the field for the last 20 years is that it's been very difficult for us to get on the other side of the increasing scope of the epidemic. And so my hope is that maybe by treating people earlier, getting people on therapy, now that we have much safer and better tolerated medications, will actually help us get on the other side of the growth of the epidemic as well.
So treatment as HIV prevention.
Yes, absolutely.
Another question I had, they didn't really cover it at this conference, was do you think we're any closer to HIV eradication?
You know, that's really hard to say. I mean, you're right. I don't think anybody even mentioned the word eradication at the conference. I think that, you know, certainly we're having revealed to us more and more potent agents. Some of the integrase inhibitors, for example, which seem to pull the viral load down more quickly even than the most powerful agents that we had before. I think that's very exciting. I think some of the novel compounds that work in different ways, some of the gene therapy studies that are going on, I think that's probably going to be the key to viral eradication, and certainly hopefully we'll get there one day.
But we're not any closer to you.
I don't see it on the horizon right now.
Mm-hmm. What are the biggest open questions in HIV research, do you think?
I think right now it's a very exciting time because I think that the treatment paradigms for how we're going to treat the whole spectrum of HIV patients is really going to change. I think that with the advent of these new agents, new ways of fighting the virus, agents that are extremely well tolerated and very difficult for the virus to develop resistance to, I think we're going to see changes in the way that we approach therapy from treatment-naive patients to early treatment-experienced patients who have failed one or two regimens to our most advanced salvage patients. So I think that's the most exciting thing for me right now is just there's some really wonderful stuff out there, and the next few years will help us to sort of sort out how we're going to combine those things and what's going to be the best thing to do for our patients.
Mm-hmm. Well, one open question, I think, is understanding metabolic complications of HIV. Are we any closer to understanding how they occur and what intervention we should take?
You know, I think that I wouldn't say that we're any closer to understanding why they occur. From the very beginning, you know, there's been this sort of umbrella of lipodystrophy or metabolic complications, and everything that we just couldn't explain, we just lumped under that umbrella of complications. And I think we still don't really understand why certain drugs seem to manifest some metabolic side effects and others manifest others. I think we are getting better and better in the drug development process at recognizing those things early on and knowing that those aren't acceptable side effects for our patients anymore. So I think the drugs that we see coming to market now are much better tolerated as far as metabolic side effects. And certainly in the short term, we're hoping in the long term because of our increased realization of really how important those things are.
I know you were the lead investigator on the DUET study. Was there a metabolic sub-study or analysis
We looked very closely at lipids and insulin resistance and those things, and patients did extremely well in the study. A lot of patients actually came in with significant hyperlipidemia because of being on very complex protease-containing regimens that tended to really affect their triglycerides and lipids. And we saw those patients improve dramatically over the course of the study. Mm-hmm. So I think we're really excited about new agents and new combinations of agents and the fact that they're going to be much better tolerated as far as metabolic side effects go.
Mm-hmm. I guess next I wanted to ask about cardiovascular complications in people with HIV. Are we any closer, do you think, in understanding how they're caused and who's responsible?
You know, I mean, I think the SMART study really opened up a whole nother realm for us as far as, wow, what's going on here? You know, because we, for so many years, really thought it was a side effect of the medications. And then when the SMART study came out and we started seeing the data there and the DSMB stopped the study, it was because of these terrible cardiovascular complications, not in the treatment group, but in the group that was getting the treatment interruptions. So I think that's kind of moved us back to this place where we think the cardiovascular complications may actually be related more to, maybe this chronic inflammatory process that takes place in the bodies of people who are constantly fighting HIV through the course of their life. And again, this might help us to decide which way the pendulum should swing. We maybe should be treating people earlier, minimize that long-term inflammatory complication, and hopefully diminish the long-term incidence of cardiovascular complications.
Mm-hmm. And I guess finally, do you think that circumcision should be adapted in the developed world for HIV prevention?
You know, I think that it's fascinating, and there were probably as many talks here on circumcision and discussion of this as there were on when to start treatment. I think it's interesting because this is an intervention that we have seen in study after study after study to be efficacious in stemming the spread of HIV, and yet we have not moved into a large-scale prevention effort by actually implementing that. So I think that there was a lot of discussion about that here and a lot of interest in that, and I think it'll be very interesting to see over the next few years what happens with that. Certainly there are cultural norms and things like that that must be addressed whenever we're talking about recommending something like this to a large population of people. But one of the things that we found in some of the preliminary studies is that populations that we thought were not going to be really receptive actually are pretty receptive. And I think if you can go into a population and offer them an intervention like this, it's going to decrease the likelihood over their lifetime that they're going to contract HIV. If you're talking about a high prevalence area like sub-Saharan Africa, then absolutely people should be very interested in that, and I think they will be.
But you don't think it'll play very well in the United States, for
instance? I think that it's interesting, I reviewed some of this stuff before I came to the meeting, and I actually thought about this before I came to the meeting. I thought, you know, do I ever sit down and talk with my patients about whether or not they should be circumcised to decrease the likelihood that they're going to contract HIV? And I really don't. I haven't moved into that, but I think the talks here at the meetings and the discussion here certainly has moved me to a point where I think that is something I should bring up with my patients. So I think it'll be interesting to see whether that's something that's more broadly adopted.
Uh-huh. But even though that, I don't know, I didn't go to all the sessions, did they address gay sex at all, or was it all heterosexual?
Well, that's one of the questions, really, is whether it makes a significant difference for the MSM population or whether it's really just efficacious for heterosexual contact. And I think we don't really know that. You know, we still have, 10, 15% of our new infections that the only risk factor they identify is unprotected oral sex. So I think there's still HIV transmission that takes place that we don't really know about. And I still have patients in my practice who convert to being HIV positive who insist that they've never been engaged in receptive anal intercourse, that they only engage in insertive intercourse, and yet they still convert and become seropositive. So I think that there probably is a role for any of those prevention interventions in the MSM community as well.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on IAS 2007 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/IAS2007.